So we never focus on looking for money. We focus on getting the right people who believe in the idea. And those people are bold enough to put their money into the idea to build a platform. So when it comes to funding, it is the people you have that matters, not the money. Because from the beginning, people may not want to give you money. But if you have just two people in your corner that believe, and if they believe enough, they can put the little they have to get things going from the beginning. Because they believe in the idea and they believe it's going to work no matter what. So the issue of funding, for us, we have the right people that believe in what we do. And we donate. We donate among ourselves and keep things going until we get to where we are now, that they don't need to donate anymore. So get the right people, and those right people, they will do anything to make that idea work. So that is my advice on that. People are the key. People matters.
Every big thing starts small. It's a natural law. Every big multinational corporation was once a small business. Welcome to the Small Starter Business Podcast, a unique podcast for practical tips and advice to help you start, grow, or turn around your business.
Welcome to another interesting episode of the Small Starter Business Podcast. I am your host, John Paul Iwoha. Today's episode is an interview format episode, and we have a very interesting guest who is going to share his insights, his journey, his experience with us. Maxwell Adieu is the founder of Quezza. I don't want to spoil the show, so I'll allow him to explain what Quezza is. But he is somebody I've worked closely with for several months, several years actually. He's a member of our Insiders program. And I wanted him to come share with the general podcast community, people who have been listening to the podcast, you know, what it feels like to be in the driver's seat of a young, fast-growing business, right? So that's exactly what we're trying to achieve with this episode. So we're very glad to have you with us, Maxwell. How are you doing? How is Accra in Ghana?
I'm very well, John Paul. Thank you for having me on the podcast. It's a great honor. We're very great and cool in Ghana. Oh. The weather is amazing, but it's hot.
Okay. Wait. So, okay, so it's hot. It's hot, but you're enjoying it, right?
Yeah, because other part of the world is extremely cold, so they will be glad to come enjoy the sun. So we need to appreciate what we have.
Wow, that's exciting. So for those people who don't know, to give some context, in West Africa right now, we're gradually emerging into the hot seasons, right? And then Ghana is particularly known to be hot at this time of year. Of averagely, right? So in the Northern Hemisphere, most of them are still grappling with winter, very cold temperatures. And if you want to look at it on the bright side, Africa is enjoying a splendid summer right now, right? That's what you're saying we should look at it as, right?
Absolutely, yes. So if you need some sunburn or you want to tan your skin, you can come to Ghana.
That's interesting. So let's head right into it. And to start off with this episode, we want to know who you are. We want to relate to the personal side of you. And rather than go through the traditional boring questions of who is Maxwell and all that, I want to put some kind of twist to it by starting with this question. So I want you to tell us something about you that most people don't know.
Wow, very nice question. Thank you, John Paul. So what people don't know about me is that I started off as in a non-profit. So I never started in a profit sector. I started in an NGO sector, and I volunteered for several years. Even after school, when I should have a paid job and I should be making money, I was a volunteer with different organizations. So that is what people don't know about me, that I didn't just become an entrepreneur, but I was in the non-profit for 10 years. And the period of that 10 years, I was a volunteer for like maybe 4 years before I started to, consult for different organizations like the UN and the rest. So I think a lot of people don't know that.
Wow, that's interesting. And on the surface, it looks very simple that you were in nonprofits, and now you are in for-profits, which is what business is. But having worked with entrepreneurs for quite some time, I realized that there is some mental block with people who are in the nonprofit. So, for example, these are people who work on passionate projects. They believe they are working on causes that they believe in. Maybe they are fighting hunger or illiteracy or something like that. One challenge I found with those kinds of people is they find it difficult to charge for something because they're already used to volunteer, free charity work, right? So when it's time for business, they find it, you know, unjustifiable that they have to charge somebody for value that they are creating. And that's a psychological, mental, emotional journey that most people may not understand if they just headed straight into entrepreneurship. So, you know, I may have to break order here to ask, you know, did you have any qualms moving from an environment of, you know, we're just doing good for the world, we're doing things we're passionate about, we're not asking people for money? How did you move from such a mindset, such an environment, into a situation now where you're providing value and you're expecting a win-win outcome where your customers pay you for the value that you provide?
I have a little bit of difficulty to migrate from a nonprofit to profit because we're already used to, you know, we wanted to solve a problem that matters to us that we're passionate about. But when I looked at it from a different angle, if we have to make a significant progress, we should solve a problem that people can pay us for, because that is when we will become sustainable. So if you look at a nonprofit world, even the United Nations, they go after money all the time. They have to beg. We have to solve this problem. Please, we need money. They continuously ask for funds, and that is not sustainable. Each of these donors can choose to give them the money or not. So when I looked at it closely, like, it is better we solve a problem, we have a cause that we believe in, we are solving that problem, and we are being paid for it, so that we can be sustainable. So when I look at that aspect, it becomes easy for me to think, look, this problem has to be paid for, instead of the traditional way that I was used to of nonprofit looking for funds to solve problem. Why can't we develop a solution to solve a problem that people can pay for, so we become self-sustained? So from that angle, I'm able to move from the nonprofit to profit.
Wow, interesting. Now, the key word that caught my attention was sustainability. And that's a very big issue with the charity model of, you know, help doing good for the world, which is great, working on your passion, which is great. But the problem is it's not a self-sustaining system. You have to keep depending on third parties. They could be donor agencies, corporate sponsors, and all sorts of people for money. But then you did a good job of contrasting it with entrepreneurship, which is a much more sustainable way of doing great things for the world. So, for example, we haven't talked about your business, but I'm sure you create value that people appreciate, and they appreciate it so much that they're willing to dig into their pockets and then pay you for it. And in your mind, there's nothing wrong with that. So it's interesting the way you've related those two worlds of profits and nonprofits, and seeing how one side is comfortable asking for money, because there's nothing wrong with that, because we need to be sustainable and we need to be less dependent on outside parties, and how the other one still feels like it's unfair to ask people for money. So I think that's a very interesting point. Now, let's look at your background. You know, so in doing some preliminary research for this podcast, I found that you actually have a master's degree from Georgetown University. I believe you studied international relations or something related to that. So I'm thinking, somebody who is this well-educated in international relations, I know that means that's one of those courses where you have a wide range of career options. Why didn't you just go look for some plum job, either in the nonprofit sector or even in the for-profit sector, get a plum job with a fat salary and live a good and happy life? Why did you choose this other path of entrepreneurship?
Wow, thank you for that question. So I will start with this quote. Someone said, the future is not a place that we go to. It is one that we create. The path, they are not to be found, but they are to be made. And in the process of making them, it changed the maker and their destination. So when I'm trying to find that future that I'm building, I started from the nonprofit with a degree, with the experience from and a bunch of organizations that I work with, including the UN and a whole lot of organizations. And during my travels, I had the opportunity to go to over 45 countries in the space of 10 years. And during my travels, especially to a lot of African countries, I realized one thing. We might be in the North and the East or West Africa, but there's something unique about Africa that I see almost everywhere, which is businesses, small businesses. And all the small businesses that I see, they have the same problem. It could be in Dakar, it could be in Cairo, it could be in Lagos. And the problem is there's infrastructure problem in terms of access to market for their products. Apart from the infrastructure problem that is access to market, business in this part of the world, they struggle. So they remain small because they can't solve all this problem by themselves. So the big companies, the corporates, those who have the money, they are the one benefiting when it comes to business in Africa. So when I went to Morocco, I visited where they process argan oil. And this argan oil is one of the most precious things that comes from Morocco. So this village, they are all women that process the oil. When I left the village, which is after Marrakesh, and you travel from this village to Marrakesh to, you don't even get to Casablanca, you found this same oil, the smallest, in a bottle for 7 euros. And these women that produce this oil, they just come, how do you sell? They say, oh, we just sell it so that we can buy bread. Could you imagine these women are processing oil just to buy bread? So these are the things that inspires me to look, instead of starting, looking for a job, this is a full-time job by itself. And that is what brought me to where I am now. That's why I use that quote. Like, we can figure out where we are going from the beginning. Even with a degree, you want to get a job. Something has to prompt us for us to know that I think this is the way I want to go. So what prompted me not to look for a job, it is this problem that I found based on all the places that I visited. And I'm like, this is a big problem and we need to do something about it. As big as it is, in fact, I don't know how to explain the problem. It's so big that sometimes it's like it's beyond our control in terms of solving a business and problem for small businesses in Africa for them to be able to grow. But it's a big problem for me and for my team entirely for us to look, I don't need to look for a job. This is a big problem and this is a job for me. So this is one of the reasons. So my journey pushed me to where I am. I didn't just decide not to look for a job or to look for a job with the qualification and the experience. So the journey pushed me not to look for a job to start and to do what I'm doing now.
Interesting. So what caught my attention is that you were drawn into the path of entrepreneurship by problems that you notice that affect small businesses. And on when you really look at this, interestingly, the natural reaction to problems is that people run away from problems. People avoid problems. But I notice that with entrepreneurs or people who are entrepreneurially minded, they tend to be attracted to problems, which is what has happened in your case. You are attracted to a problem that afflicts small businesses. And then the second interesting thing you said is that this is actually a job, right? Some people tend to think entrepreneurship is a lifestyle that is freer, has less problems, or is less stressful than a full-time office job. But I guess you can tell them that this is actually harder than any job you can ever find. So it's not as if you avoided an easier option, because this is actually harder. But I guess there's a sense of fulfillment that comes from it. And this nicely segues into what you actually do right now, because it appears that it's this problem you notice with small businesses that drew you out of the nonprofit sector and, inspired you to start your own company, which is called Queza. Now, apart from telling us exactly how you came up with that name, Queza, what it stands for, I think this would be a good time to tell us about the company you started on the basis of the problems you noticed in your travels across Africa. What exactly is Queza? What exactly does it do? And who are the customers that you serve?
Thank you. So Queza is a B2B, we're a pan-African e-commerce platform. But we cater for both formal and informal medium micro and small-sized business in Africa, for them to be able to trade globally. Our focus and our market right now is in the US, Canada, and in the UK. So we exist to break barriers that limit small businesses to sell. No matter how small you are in a corner somewhere in Togo or in Lagos, and you're thinking about who's going to buy my product, not even outside. How can I sell my product globally? How can I attract global markets? And I'm so small. I don't have the money for advert. I don't even know how to go about it. Then we are your partner because we see our merchant as our partner, because their success is our success and their failure is our failure. We are partners. So it's not just we are servicing small businesses. We partner with small businesses because if we don't know who you are, what you said, how you said it, how we can help you grow your business from producing 5 shoe or 5 shea butter or 5 honey to producing 100, 200 and up to container where you can be servicing all the retail stores out there, then we are neglecting the fact that you can't just be big all of a sudden. Once you are small, we take you through the process. So that is what we do at Quasar. We exist to enable businesses in Africa, both formal and informal, medium, micro, and small size, to trade globally and build their value chain wherever they deem fit. So our customer is African businesses, formal and informal, micro, small, and medium size, including the manufacturers and retailers of various African products, including food, clothing, and healthcare products. So that is what we do at Quasar. And it's not just about using technology like our mobile app or our web to sell. We have offline for those who cannot use technology, because we realize that majority of the businesses in Africa are still informal. So how can we take them through the process of you have not even registered your business and you want to ship abroad? Maybe you start with sole proprietorship. Then from there, you cannot use an app. We have a staff that can, you know, check your product if it meets the standard, if you need a FDA approval, if it's food, if it's poorly packaged, how can we package it for you? Then we ship the product to stores, but stores to tell us how it is, if it's good or they want something changed. Then we come back to you, we take you through the process of making sure that the product meets the international standard. And for people in the US who are very choosy and very picky, your product has to meet the standard. So we take you through that process as an informal. I have your product out there in the various stores in the US and Canada. Basically, that is what we do at Quasar.
Interesting. So in a nutshell, you help African merchants, small businesses in Africa, access new markets. And these are even markets in the developed world where I presume they can charge better prices for their products. They can grow their sales because now they are selling to an international audience. And then these businesses can become bigger and better. They can hire more people. They can pay more taxes. They can create wealth and prosperity. Now, the very premise of what Quasar does is a bit counterintuitive, because all this time we've been hearing that Africa mainly imports. Africa just sells raw materials like crude oil and gold and silver and copper, that we import everything, including toothpicks, right? So I think it's a bit, it's both inspiring and shocking that there are small businesses that can actually export things outside this continent. So I think the very first question would be, who wants things from Africa? What kinds of things are the people on your platform exporting? And who out there in the US and Canada is looking for products from Africa? So I'm asking on behalf of somebody who may be startled that, you know, with all this news in the media that Africa is a major importer. We import from China, import from the US, import from everywhere. And here you are telling us that there are small businesses that can actually sell products outside of Africa. So the curiosity is, who exactly is buying these things from Africa, and where is the demand coming from?
So thank you. People buy from all over. But the major market is in the US and Europe. And those people that are buying are retail stores. If you go to the US or Canada, for example, you see Africa World Market in a place like Canada. You see the African Town Project, the first African Town Project right now in Philadelphia. You see even Walmart, Dragon stores, all the stores, they buy African products. These are the people who are buying. The Africans in the diaspora
who wanted to eat their food, wear their clothes, who wanted to buy the raw healthcare products that are not, you know, processed. These are the people buying. The African-Americans who wanted to, you know, who chose their route back home and they want African clothing and food. Those are the people that are buying the product from us. Those are the people that are buying the product from us. So we have over 1 million retail stores in the U.S. and Canada that are buying African product in large quantity. So those are the targets.
Interesting. And one thing I heard is that, or rather I know, because of the volume of remittances that are coming from places like the U.S. and U.K. and France, there's a large population of Africans who are living outside of Africa, the people we call the African diaspora. And I can imagine that you don't just travel to the U.S. and the U.K. and forget your local food and all those things you were eating when you were growing up. All those tastes are still there. So I can imagine that people still want their garri, their palm oil, their local honey, all the foods that they've always known all their lives. And they are introducing these things to their children, right? And you also mentioned that, you know, this whole thing about organic, it's like the whole world now is crazy for organic because of all this whole genetically modified foods and stuff like that. I think Africa is still seen as a place where you can still get pure and natural, unadulterated, unprocessed food, you know, that's direct from nature. So that presents a major opportunity, and not just within the Africans who are living outside of Africa, but other people, white people, brown people, Chinese, everybody, you know, that presents a major opportunity. But then if I were a skeptic, the question I'll ask is, you know, if there's a market out there for African products and services, for African products particularly, since we're talking e-commerce, why should I bother using Kweza? Why don't I just go ahead and look for customers myself and ship myself? Why are you necessary as a middleman? Because the truth is, Kweza is just a middleman between the seller and the buyer. Why are you necessary? Can't I just cut you out and do it my way?
Good question. So all the stores, they have been buying from somewhere, all the stores before Kweza ever exist. How do they buy it? I was in a store in Philadelphia owned by a Chinese. Everything there is from Africa except the seller, who is not an African. Everything. And I asked her, how do you source for the product? They've been duped a lot of time. They try to buy it, connect with people. They lose their money. They get half of the product. She told me, we put money together. A Chinese woman, we send somebody to Africa, one of us, who source the product from the locals, get the product, put it in a container, and ship it to the U.S. When the product gets to the U.S., we store it in our warehouse, then we redistribute to our stores. People who put the money together who are going to buy. So now, that is what they've been doing. And that takes a lot of money. They need to pay plane ticket. She says sometimes it takes them 2 months to sort the product. Plane ticket, a lot of cost goes into it, a lot of time goes into it, and they don't have all of those times. So this is why they need Kweza. They don't need to get on the plane again to come to Africa to source it. They can source it through us. One. Two, those who are very skeptical to buy it directly or to look for informal channel that they don't know, now they can trust us because they know when they pay through Kweza, they get the product. Three, the logistic aspect of it. Sometimes they go through a lot of headache to get to ship the product. We provide solution also on the logistic. The payment now, they don't need to. If you come to Africa to buy this product, you have to carry cash. You can't go to the village and give them a card payment. So we make the payment easy. So instead of them using cash, they can do wire to us, and we can take care of the sourcing from all the merchants on our platform. So what we are giving them is a painkiller. It's not a vitamin C, because the vitamin C is, I can live without it. But the painkiller, when you go to a doctor, you said you need pain, and the doctor give you a painkiller. You don't ask the doctor, what type of painkiller? Is it good? You just take the painkiller and use it because you are in pain. So what we provide to them is a painkiller. We save them a lot of money. We save them a lot of time. And they can just sit right there in the stores in the U.S. and source the product to us from the merchant on our platform. And this is another thing. It's more cheaper. Now, when they go to the locals, a Chinese who come to Ghana will not travel all the way to the north. to buy the product themselves. They connect with another middleman who is a Ghanaian who will take them through to the village. And that will cost them extra money. So now all of those costs, they cut it off. They just sit right there in their store and the product comes to them. So this is why they need us. Also the merchants who won't have the capacity to sell, they will not ship their product without getting the money. Nobody will ship product to anybody without getting the money from Africa. And a lot of these merchants need money to produce if you order a lot. So for the merchant, they also need us because whatever quantity you can sell will take you through the process of even if it's 5 kilo, you can still sell. And you are guaranteed that I'm going to get my money on Kweza if I send the product. Even I haven't received the money, but I ship the product, they are very certain they will get paid. Unlike without Kweza, they can't ship the product because they're not sure they will get their money. So this is why both of them need us.
Interesting. This is so you've answered a lot of questions that I've encountered at different points in my career working with entrepreneurs, both within the continent and outside, especially those outside who are trying to come in. And one common complaint is that Africa is like, if you're trying to do business in Africa for the first time, or even after the first time, Africa is like a black box. You don't know where to find the products, at least the credible ones or the ones that you want. You don't know who to trust. You don't know where to get information. Payment is very difficult. So I like the way you explained this because you touched on each of those points. But there were four of them that came to mind, which are common threads when people complain about trying to source something from Africa or buy something from Africa. The first one you talked about is the travel. You know, Africa is still like manual. You need to have boots on the ground. You have to come by yourself, see the products, touch it by yourself, look the person in the eye and know if you can trust that person, right? It's very manual. And it's strange that this sort of thing still happens in the 21st century when everything these days is like you put on your phone and then you can get anything done. The second one is the time that is lost because of the manual way things are still done in many parts of Africa, especially when it comes to commerce for informal businesses. A lot of time is lost. You have to look at three or four different potential suppliers, all those decisions, the time invested in travel, both international travel, local travel. It's just a lot of wasted time. The third one you talked about is logistics. And that one is a major elephant. How do you get products from where they are produced to the ports? Even at the ports is a different matter. Sometimes you can be held back because you don't have certain papers. There are delays at the ports. And if you're shipping perishable items, this can be a major problem. And then we come to the grandfather of all the major problems, which is payments. You can imagine that even to send money from Ghana to Nigeria is, you know, can be difficult, let alone when it's a B2B, business-to-business transaction. So this is quite interesting because what you're doing is you've taken all those problems, you found a solution to these problems in terms of Kweza, and you're saying rather than you're a merchant in the US and you're trying to buy something from Africa, rather than go through all those hoops, rather than talk to all those middlemen, just talk to one person, Kweza. You're like a one-stop shop for getting things out of Africa by way
absolutely
of people are sourcing. Good. This is fantastic. So, you know, that name Kweza, it's quite curious because it's a beautiful name. It sounds African from just the mention. It has two U's in the name. Where exactly does this name come from? What exactly does it mean? And why did you choose it?
So thank you for that question. We wanted to portray African identity. We wanted people to know us for who we are. So we thought about a name that is so unique. So we combine different African language together. So if you go to Kenya in Swahili, when they say Kweza, it means a marketplace in Swahili. So also in South Africa, some part of African language Isizulu in South Africa, it also means something like buy or market. So you come to Akan in Ghana, it's sort of, it has a blend of also a market. So we want people to ask, what does Kweza mean? So we didn't just choose a direct name that you can easily figure out or an English name that you've been used to. So we combine all of these different African language together because we serve African markets and we call it Kweza.
Interestingly, for people who do not understand the size and scale of the African continent, You know, Kenya is very far from South Africa, and South Africa is very far from Ghana. But in all that distance, you're still seeing the connection via language, where this name, Kweza, K-U-U-E-Z-A, means something around buying, selling, markets, marketplace, and stuff like that. And I think this is a lesson in branding, that I think the very first act of branding that any business does is the day you choose the name of your company. Because it's like the day you christen a child or give that child a name. That name tends to define you. It gives people an impression of you. It talks for you even before you actually talk. So I like that the name from the get-go is screaming all shades of I'm African, I'm like market African, buy African, sell African, Africa in the center of it all. So I want to thank you for being very patriotic with this. If I dare say, you know, sometimes I tend to compare what you do with what Jack Ma did with Alibaba in China. What you're trying to do now is very similar, because as at the time China was still trying to open up to the world, it was very difficult to do business in China if you're a foreigner. The first barrier was the language. The second is the country is massive. The third is it's a different system. It's a communist country. The rules are a bit different. So China was quite difficult for people who were either in the US or even in Africa who wanted to buy cheaper and more affordable products from China. But how could you do business in China? And then here comes Alibaba. Alibaba provides structure. You can go in there. You can look for potential suppliers. You can have conversations around price, around quantity, around delivery terms and stuff like that. Alibaba handled payments. So the seller was happy, the buyer was happy, because you don't get paid or you don't pay until you get what you ordered for. So I see many parallels between Alibaba and what you're doing. But what I think you did far better than Alibaba is that anywhere you mention Alibaba, at least for today, we know it's coming out of China. Alibaba is from China. But there's really nothing in Alibaba that is exclusively Chinese. Not even the Ali, which I think is much more Middle Eastern, or the Baba, which is like a global name for, you know, father and all that. So I like what you did with Kweza, making it wholly, uniquely, and screaming African. So that's a very, very interesting job. So now that we've talked about the business and the company, for those people in our audience who listen to the podcast because of what they learn about entrepreneurship, what it actually takes to be an entrepreneur, the suffering, the pains, the enjoyment, and all that, I want us to go behind the scene of Kweza. And I think the very first question off the top of my mind is, when you had that idea, when you saw those women in Morocco and how much pain they were going through converting their oil to earn an income just to buy bread, when you saw those kinds of problems across the African continent and you thought to yourself, I want to do something about this. I want to build something that can solve this. The truth is, at that point, you were working in nonprofit and it was just an idea. Can you talk us through, in as short as possible as you can, how you were able to transform that idea into the real business that it is right now, that has real customers and is actually solving the problem?
It's a difficult one. So for me to be able to, you know, from idea to reality took like 3 years. I have different co-founders, and after 3 months, they would disappear. They said, I need to look for a job, Maxwell. I can't do this. So it was so difficult because people see a lot of problems in what we are trying to solve. They look at the logistics problem. They look at everything. There's a problem. They go, I mean, this is going to be too much problem. Are you sure we can do this? So I had a lot of setback. And I had a lot of people who say, okay, yeah, let's do it. In a couple of 1-2 months, they disappear. So how we're able to make it happen is the few people who believe in the vision. So where we are is all about people. It's all about my team. It's all about the board. It's all about our advisors, people like you, who believe, who see beyond, like, you know, of course, there's a problem, but this is possible. So it's difficult. It's difficult because our type of business has so much challenges, more than normal businesses, where it is just direct. But this is not direct. you need to deal with a merchant in Africa, which is difficult. You know, a merchant in Africa can tell you, oh, any quantity of product I'll supply. And whereas you can't even supply 50 kilos. When you are ready and you tell a buyer, oh, our merchant is ready, and it disappears. So you look bad to the buyer. Those are problems. Challenges, problem, regulation, custom duty, it's beyond our control. We can't control that. It's government who deals in all of those things. So everybody that I spoke with from the beginning are like, Lord, how can you tell me somebody in Nigeria will sell to a store in the UK or another country? How is that possible? It's not possible because they are looking at the problem. So the only way we are able to make it a reality is the people, the few people who believe that let's do it. Let's do it. We can do it. Let's do it. And we started gradually. Even the app alone took us like 2 years, 8 months to come up with a wireframe on how the app should look like. So we're just going back and forth for 2-3 years, just trying to put thoughts together, trying to develop it. And that's a lot of time for a lot of people. They can't wait. They have families to feed. They have things to do. So a lot of people left from the beginning. But few people who believe in the idea that, look, this is possible, you know, they're always there. And they said, no, we can make it happen. So I think the most prized asset that helps us get to where we are is our people, our staff, our team, our board. The people, the right people, are the people that get us to where we are.
Interesting. Good. So... it's, you know, when we talk about ideas, when most people talk about their ideas, they're very excited. For some people, they go as far as seeing how they will become a millionaire, how they'll be on the back of Forbes, how they'll be celebrated in the media, because the idea is going to make them a lot of money, right?
Yes.
Then, the reality of executing that idea sets in. You then realize that you have to now put, you have to invest your time, your money, your efforts. You have to make sacrifices to make this idea happen. And it's true, from what you said, you got some co-founders, and when they saw that, you know, this is like a full contact sport, by the time they get punched in the face a couple of times, everybody runs away, and some people are going to look for a job, some people are going to look for something else to do. And you really hit it right there on the head. You must either be a crazy person or have full belief in what you're building. If not, you're going to drop it and run away. Because it's not for the faint-hearted. You're going to face challenges. You're going to face all kinds of characters, all kinds of things. And I think you put it very well when you said people. Because at the end of the day, the thing that makes an entrepreneur is your ability to convince other people to follow you in the direction you're headed. And those people don't have to be employees. They can be advisors, like the relationship we have between the two of us. They can be employees, they can be partners, they can be even investors. Somebody who listens to you and says, you know, this thing you've just said right now is crazy, or it's difficult, or it sounds like it's impossible, but I believe in it. I think you can do it. Yeah, I agree with you that the people you are able to convince to join you on that journey, because again, it's not a sprint, it's a marathon. And anybody who has watched a marathon will know that it's a very funny kind of race. Some people start with a lot of energy in the beginning, and then halfway in, they drop by the wayside, or they collapse, or they give up, or, you know, something. So it's something that will really test your patience. And I think the next thing I want to ask is a common excuse, and it's an excuse, but it's also a valid reason why some people say they cannot do anything about their business ideas, and that is capital. So somebody tells you, I have an amazing business idea, but the biggest problem I have is I don't have capital to make the business a reality. Now, you were able to make that transition from idea into real business. So what is your take on this issue of capital? How did you manage with raising capital? And you said it took you 2 years to build the app and other things that you did. But essentially, what's your own take on this capital thing? How did you overcome this problem?
So for the financial aspect of it, I'm still going to go back to the people. You couldn't believe that one of our core team members was paying our bills for like 1 year. Just for us, so during the development process, when we are not making a dime. He just said, look, I believe in this. So for my salary, I can put this down. And a lot of people, few of my team who are still with us right now, they were taking out $50 from their pay, wherever they are doing some other job, to support financially from the beginning when we have no money. And this kept us through the process. So we actually paid from our post to build the platform from the beginning. So we never focus on looking for money. We focus on getting the right people who believe in the idea. And those people are bold enough to put their money into the idea to build the platform. So when it comes to funding, it is the people you have that matters, not the money. Because from the beginning, people may not want to give you money. But if you have just two people in your corner that believe, and if they believe enough, they can put the little they have to get things going from the beginning. Because they believe in the idea and they believe it's going to work no matter what. So the issue of funding for us, we have the right people that believe in what we do. And we donate. We donate among ourselves and keep things going until we get to where we are now, that they don't need to donate anymore. So get the right people, and those right people, they will do anything to make that idea work. So that is my advice on that. People are the key. People matters. It could be your co-founder, your team, it could be anyone. But once they believe, the key thing is they believe in what you do. And from the beginning, when you are in ideation stage, they can support you. Because ideation stage in Africa is very difficult. Nobody will give you money. Not only in Africa, it's difficult. You know, I want to build this thing. I need money. Have you built it? That's the question. So nobody cares how much you know until you show how much you care. They need to see your commitment. Like, you're serious about what you're doing. You believe in that thing strong enough to cough your last coin into it. That is what will motivate others to put money into your business. So from the beginning, don't focus on looking for money, because it may not work.
So, in fact, I think it's genius the way you bring this back to people, right? So when I asked you about how did you make the transition from idea into a real business, you talked about people. They're important. I ask you again about how you overcame the capital, raising money, that challenge. It's all back to people. And, you know, the thing is, you don't sound like a Barack Obama or some sales guy or some person who is, like, very skillful at, changing people's minds. Do you have magical powers? What did you tell these people that got them on board? So I guess my question would be, you know, what's your number one tip for finding, attracting, and keeping the right kind of people that will stand with you thick and thin, up to the extent where they are bringing money out of their own pockets to support a vision that they believe in? What exactly did you tell them? What did you do?
That's a very interesting question. So in my case, I'll use my experiences. I think relationship is very important. So you can't just go to people and ask for things, but without having a relationship with them. So I built a good relationship with a lot of people that are currently part of my team. And it's a bit easy for them to trust me because of the relationship we have previously. I'm not saying real friends, but professional relationship. And the second thing is, you have to be honest from the beginning with the people that you're trying to bring on board. You have to be very honest with them. Look, what we are getting into may not pay off easily, but you have the ability to convince them, to help them see the bigger picture. So you have to have the ability to influence others. So I'm able to influence them to see the bigger picture. So when I'm talking to them, I tell them, let's look at the problems that small businesses face. Let's look at how big it is. Let's look at what we can achieve in the next 10 years. And let's look at how much smiles we can put on those business faces. How much smile from someone who is selling 5 now can sell 50. That is the key thing about what we do. That is what I tell them. Let's look at the vision. So I'm able to sell the vision and help them see the bigger picture. If in the next 10 years we have 1 million businesses, that means 1 million small businesses are paying tax. 1 million small businesses are paying school fees for their kids. 1 million small businesses are paying, they can put food on their table. 1 million small businesses are employing more people. So we're actually creating jobs indirectly. If a small business can start to produce more, they need more hands, they will employ. Look at that big picture. That is what we are, that's where we are going. That is where we want to get to. So when I'm talking to anyone, I sell the vision and I convince them that this is not about in the next 5 years you become a billionaire. No, this is about you're going to solve a problem and those people will thank you for it and you'll be more fulfilled. And on top of that, you even make money. And a lot of them are able to see, this guy is saying the right thing. That is how I'm able to influence them. I sell the bigger picture.
Interesting. This is powerful stuff. So I like how this practical experience of yours validates a lot of the things that we know about business. So, for example, people hear about the vision and the mission of a company. And in some companies, these things are dead. They are just things you write and frame and put on a wall somewhere and people just read it or something on your website, but it's not alive. It's just dead. When you ask people, what's your vision? They tell you, our vision is to become, and they just reel out this, and you know, they crammed it, you know, they're just spitting it out. They don't really know what it means. They don't believe in it. They're just saying it, right? What you've just said right now brings life into what a vision should be and what a mission should be. The vision is what draws you. It's what lures you. It's what entices you. It's what motivates you. That's why you said you're selling them 10 years from now. Imagine if we're helping 1 million businesses, what that could be. That's the big picture. And usually when people dream about the money they can make, it's because of the vision. But if you only sell the vision, you'll be deceiving people because the vision will require hard work. It will require sacrifice. And that's where the mission comes in. The mission is the hard work. The mission is a problem we're solving. The mission is what we're going to be doing every day, tomorrow, day after tomorrow. The mission is every day. The vision is 10 years, 20 years. So I really want to thank you for how your practical knowledge and then how you've explained this has brought some of these things to life. Because if those things don't mean anything, people will not sacrifice for them. People will not follow you. People will not believe you. Yeah. So it's not just about sitting somewhere and writing a vision that is flowery or that sounds good. If people don't believe it, they are not going to follow you. So before we move into the next round of the interview, I just wanted for those people who are curious and are sitting on the edge of their seats and want to know, you know, this whole Kweza thing, how can I get involved? So I have a small business. I want to sell products to customers in the US, in Canada, in the UK. How do I get started? Is this in a website? Is it an app? Is it a phone call? Do I have to go to their office? Where is their office? What is the process? How much does it cost? Please just bring peace to our minds now and let us know how exactly does one get started with Kweza and what does it involve?
Thank you very much. So I mentioned earlier that we deal with both informal and formal sector. So if you are in the formal sector, you know how to use a smart technology, download an app. You know, you have a smartphone, you have internet, and you're in the formal sector. You can use all of these things. You go to Play Store, you search. If you are a seller, you want to start selling an African product. You go to Kweza, you go to Play Store, Apple Store, and you type Kweza Seller. KUUEZA, Kweza Seller. If you are a retailer in the US or anywhere, or you want to buy African products, you go to Play Store, Apple Store, you search for Kweza User. So once you download this app, either as a seller, as a user, you see varieties of African products on the app. You can chat with a buyer directly, ask them for quotation, and anything you ask, they will tell you. We even send samples. If you want to see sample of those products, especially if it's food product, you want to know how it tastes, how it's packaged, you can get a sample for free from any of those merchants. That is if you are going to buy. So if you are a merchant, once you download the app, it's very self-explanatory. It tells you to enter your mobile phone number. We need an ID for you to start selling because we need to know who is selling on our platform. We're going to start paying you. So we need a valid government ID for you to start to set up your shop, upload your product, and everything on the app. So next month, we're going to have a website out, which is a full B2B website that once you log in as a seller, you can list your products on the website. The same thing you are doing on the app, you'll be able to do it on Quasar.com, where you set up your shop on our website. And as a buyer, you can sort for products from different African countries. It will show you the flag of Ghana or Nigeria. It will ask you, where are you going to buy your product from? Once you click on the flag of the country, it gives you varieties of manufacturer, retailer, and product from that country. And you can start talking directly with all those manufacturer, retailer of that product. So that is on the website. So if you are in the informal sector, you don't know how to use smartphone or you don't have internet, that is where we have a representative who will contact you. So that once you contact us, you just call us or you email us, or you cannot send email, but at least you can make a call. Once you call us, our representative will take you through the informal channel process, which is to ask you questions about your product, to check how good is your product, how well is the package, if it needs improvements, and all of those things. Then we can start to put you on our We Exchange. The We Exchange is both for formal and informal, but a lot of the informal sector that doesn't know how to use a smartphone or go on a website, take advantage of the We Exchange, where they have their product in the store. This is not online now, it's offline. So that is one of the unique value proposition about us. We have our product online and we have it offline in the stores. So those who don't come online can still go to the stores and buy the products in the US and Canada and the UK. So that is an informal sector. So we deal with the informal sector directly ourselves. We manage their account for them. We set up how they want to be paid. We do a lot of programs, monthly program that enable business, that take a business from one stage to the other, including how to brand your product, what are the type of product to ship, what do I know about shipping to different countries, how can I scale my business, how can I raise funding or seed funding to start a business. Every problem that are related to business, we take all our businesses through that process, where we come up with these programs every month that address different topics that are related to business. So that is how to go about using our platform.
Okay, so interesting. In summary, you have two different apps for people. So if you're a seller, you have to download the Quasar Seller app, and it's on the Play Store or the Apple App Store. And
yes.
If you want to buy products on Quasar, so maybe you're in the US, or even you're, so for example, if I'm in Nigeria, as I am, and I want to buy a product from Ghana or Senegal, can I also, do I also qualify to buy on Quasar?
That's a very good one. So our business is not just focusing in the West. It's also within how can we increase intra-African trade, especially with the free trade area. How can we take advantage of you want to buy product from Ghana, you just get on the app and source for product from Ghana and ask how will it be shipped to you, what is the price. Yes, absolutely. So you can sort. Africans can buy product from different other African countries.
Wow. So this is exciting on very different dimensions. So listening to this episode from the beginning, one would think this is a platform that just helps people who are outside of Africa buy products from merchants who are in Africa. But right now, you have properly clarified that point, that this is a product that is both for inter-African trade, that is international trade, Africans selling outside of Africa, and intra-African, where Africans in one country can buy from African merchants in another country. This is amazing. This is very, very important. The other thing I wanted to mention is, in your explanation, you talked about the kind of support that you provide for people who sign up, either by way of information or hand-holding, because you mentioned something about reps. So it appears you have representatives in many of the countries that you operate in who can actually help those informal merchants who might not be very good with smartphones or technology. Those guys can help to onboard them and then put them through the process of how they can start trading on Quasar. And I think another interesting point that I caught is that your merchants can deliver free samples. I'm sure that will be music to the ears of anybody who is thinking of buying something, because the first challenge you have when you're trying to buy from an African merchant is that whole skepticism. Will it be up to the quality that I expect? Will the quantity be right? Will it be safe? Will it be properly packaged? All these things you can get out of the way by ordering for a sample. So if you order the sample and you like it, then it's likely that when you order the main stuff, you're also going to like it. So I like that you have thought through not just the problems, but the way people think about these problems. And I must really, really give you kudos for that. You also mentioned the WeExchange platform. And I think you now have stores in the US, for example, where rather than a buyer wait until the product ships from Africa, you can actually ship the products you already have in your store. Is that correct?
Yes. So you don't wait for someone to buy it directly from the US or from the UK. Then that's when you ship. Now they are in the store. So once they come to your buy from you, they can just pick it up from the store, or the store can send it directly to them. We just want to cut off the waiting period. You know, when you ship a product from Africa to the UK or the US, if it's not here, which is 4 or 5 days, it takes time. So now you can just get it in a day or two.
This is really, really going places, guys. So at this point in the episode, just take a note of it. If you're a seller, note the Queza seller app. That is one major app that should go up your to-do list. Download it on your device. You never can tell when you're going to need it. And start playing with this stuff, right? If you want to buy products, if you're listening to this outside the African continent, either you're of African heritage or not, and you're really thinking of exploring African products, download the Queza user app. And as he has explained, all the support, all the help you need to get you through that whole process, you're going to find on the app. So let's segue into the next round of this interview. We're heading towards the end, and this is like the lightning round. We want to test how you think about some of the interesting things that many people who listen to the Small Starter Business Podcast are passionate about. So the way it works is I'm going to mention something, and you tell me in one word or one phrase or one sentence, as short as possible, what that means to you. We don't want you to think too much. We want to really get the raw reaction from you. We don't want any delays. If you delay, you've lost the game, right? Are you ready?
Yes, I'm ready.
Good. So the first word is Africa.
Ghana.
Of course you would say Ghana. Of course you would say Ghana. I expect you to be proud of your country. Okay. The second word is entrepreneurship.
Jack Ma.
Oh, now we see where your role models are. Okay, Jack Ma, which makes sense. For those who don't know, Jack Ma is the founder of Alibaba. Alibaba is a business I talked about earlier that opened the doors of China for small and mid-sized businesses in China to supply their products across the world. So Jack Ma is a founder of Alibaba, and we're hoping that in 5-10 years from today, we can mention that Maxwell Adu, the founder of Queza, was the one who opened the doors to small and mid-sized businesses in Africa to be able to export to other parts of the world. Okay, so the first
was
Africa. The second is entrepreneurship. The third word is money.
Cedis.
Okay, good. Cedis is the currency. Cedis is the currency of Ghana, which is the country Maxwell is from. The fourth word is success.
Maxwell.
Maxwell. So, no, but to be candid, you know, we're having a conversation where most of the audience were usually entrepreneurs. And a common word you find with entrepreneurs is, I want to be successful. And what you find sometimes is that what successful means to one person is often different from what it means to another person. For somebody, the success might be money. I want to make a lot of money. I want to become the richest person in the world. For some other person, if they haven't bought a private jet, they don't think they're successful. For some people, they want fulfillment. For them, it's passion. For some, it's impact. They want to solve a major problem. So I've come to see that success has different shades and different colors. So to you, Maxwell, what exactly does success mean to you?
So you mentioned it briefly, which is impact. To me, when if I'm able to solve problem for 1,000 people, then I'm successful. Because I believe that success is contagious. When everybody around us wins, that is when we truly win. So it's not individualistic. It's about everyone. So if everybody around me wins, and then I am successful.
Okay, so you don't want to become like the richest person in Ghana, which means that you have to be above every other person when it comes to the amount of money you have in your bank account.
No, I don't think it's about the money. Someone can steal money and rob a bank and become a billionaire. For that person, I'd be a success. So I don't think that is unique. Anybody can make money, whichever way, crook or whichever way. But I believe there are things that are so unique, that are so individual. So success is very individualistic. So that's why I put it that way, that when people around me win, or when the people that we serve wins, to me, that is success. I'm successful, and I'll be fulfilled. When everybody is around me is successful, through me, they are successful, then that's a true success to me.
Interesting. So success to you means I win only when we win, right?
Exactly. Everybody wins, yes.
Okay. So the last word I have for you in this lightning round is failure. What does failure mean to you?
I think failure is somehow part of success. So sometimes we have to fail. Not sometimes. A lot of times we have to fail for us to be successful. So we have to embrace both, for me. It's a two side of a coin. This failure and success, they're almost similar. So if you do not embrace failure, you may not be successful. So for me, failure means being successful. So a lot of people have failed, and that is why they are successful. So if you have not failed before, you may not be successful. So I rather fail at doing something than being successful at doing nothing.
Okay, so this is one of those counterintuitive areas. When I deal with entrepreneurs who started the informal way, they never went to like proper school, maybe they only went to elementary school, primary school, and for the rest of their lives, they've been in pure business. They've not had any exposure to corporate environments. They've never really worked for a structured company. I tend to notice that those guys talk about failure just like you did. They have a different understanding of failure. They tend to see failure as a part of success, as part of the journey. But what I find is, with those people who move from structured environments, like from academia, where you have to go and you write exams, maybe you have your university degree or you have a diploma. In your own case, you have a master's degree. In that kind of structured environment, failure is not tolerated. The moment you fail, you're looked down on. You might be kicked out of the class. There might be consequences for your failure. So nobody in a structured environment wants to fail. So what I want to understand is, how did you make the mindset shift? You have a master's degree. You didn't get that master's degree by failing your way. You had to pass exams and then stuff like that. So how did you structure your mindset from that kind of thinking to the one you have now, where it's okay to fail? It's not a big deal. In fact, I expect to fail. How did you make that transition?
So I think experience taught me that transition beyond the classroom. So because we have a degree, because we pass through the four walls of university, that will not make us successful. So I think the experience taught me that you must embrace failure before you are successful, especially from the beginning when things are not going right, when we don't even know where to start or begin from. So if I look at how much we have failed, I would have given up. So all those experiences combined tells me, look, this is part of the journey. So if you have not failed, you may not succeed. All of those experiences taught me that lesson. Unlike before, you have a project, no, failure is not accepted, just like you said. But the experience, the real life experience, you know, taught me that education, the degree that we have, will not make us successful. It will only refine us. But when it gets to the real life, that is where the real work is. And if you don't learn that you will fail at some point, then you may not be successful. So for me, experience taught me.
Good. It's interesting how there are some things we learn in class, and there are some things we can only learn through experience. Mm-hmm. And I think failure and how to think about failure is one of those things you will never learn in a structured or classroom environment, because you are insulated from risk. Somebody else is taking the risk for you. Maybe the person who is sponsoring your education, maybe your employer, the CEO, the company that pays you a salary, is insulating you from that risk. So that's why, you know, there's a different relationship with failure. So I thank you very much for making that point, that it's not about just thinking or wanting. It's from doing that you actually learn some of these things. So we're rounding up the episode right now. And I can imagine that there's somebody who's listening to this who is thinking, you know, apart from all these very intelligent things that this guy has said, you know, and, you know, some of them scary, you know, because for some people, they might not be comfortable with failure, right? Now, so is this really what you are? Are you just all about Kweza? When you are not building your company, when you are not working, what do you do for fun? What other side of you is there? What do you do that is not serious? How do you decompress from all the pressure and all the tension and stress that comes with being an entrepreneur and running the business?
I like to be an actor. it's actually on my bucket list that I'm going to act for fun sometimes in the next couple of years when I have time. So if I'm not run, apart from being an entrepreneur, I think acting. As a matter of fact, when I started out, when I was younger, I did some soap opera, and I was like, oh, I'm going to make a good actor. But I guess I don't want to be an actor, so I never pursued that career. But I love to act, and I that is one thing I do apart from being an entrepreneur. And I'm going to act one day, so watch out for the movie.
So what we want to get now is, you're telling us you will be an actor later, or if you were not an entrepreneur. So what I'm trying to dig into is, are you a closet actor right now? Do you act in hidden places?
No, I don't, but I want to. That's what I do for fun. So if I see with my family, sometimes they've said, action, act like this guy when we are watching any movie. And I would demonstrate, they'll say, oh, cut, action.
Boy. So that's your own way of maybe making fun of other people or fun of yourself. That's your own way of decompressing. And
absolutely.
That's interesting. And one curious last question, or more or less the question before the last is, if there's something you have learned about entrepreneurship or building a business, what is that one thing you think people tend to overlook or just don't understand about this whole thing about entrepreneurship? One thing that you think people may not understand or they overlook, but it's very important.
I think what people overlook, based on my experience in an entrepreneurship journey, is the ability to influence people to believe in your vision. So when people started a business, they don't focus on that aspect of they need people. So an entrepreneur, I need money to start a business. But it doesn't realize that behind the money you're looking for, behind the success of that business, is ability to influence others. So they don't focus on that. If you ask a 10 entrepreneur right now a question, I'm sure 9 or 10 is, we want to raise funds. They will never tell you, oh, I need to influence others that will make that business successful. There's a survey conducted by Y Combinator last year. What are the things that a startup doesn't really look at? And it's team, the right people that will actually, in that right people, the money that you're looking for might come, just like in my case. So I think they don't look at that aspect thoroughly, because behind anything you want to become in life, there's somebody at the door. And that person will either close the door against you or open it for you.
Nicely put. And at the end of that sentence, we just put Maxwell Adu, founder Kweza. Because, you know, that's a very wonderful quote. You know, behind every door you're trying to go through, there is a person. And that person can choose to open the door for you or close the door in your face. I think the only thing that will make a difference is your ability to convince that person to say, I am worthy of this door. And you can ask the person to, you know, open it for you. So
exactly.
How can anyone who is listening to this contact you, keep in touch with you and your company? Because you are on your own growth trajectory. And my vision, my prophecy, based on what I'm seeing, and anybody who's listened to you, now this session has run for over an hour, anybody who's listened to you would know that these are the beginnings of something mighty, you know, that are coming. So anybody who wants to follow you, follow your work, follow your company, how exactly do they get in touch with you? Are you a Facebook person? Are you more active on Twitter? Are you part of the Instagram? Or, as you're an actor, do you dance on TikTok? Is that
So I'm more active on LinkedIn. So you can check me out, Maxwell Adio, on LinkedIn, and you can follow me or connect with me whichever way. If you want to reach out to us, visit www.queza.com or send us an email at info@queza.com. So just check it out at www.queza.com or queza.com. Don't forget that name, K-U-U-E-Z-A. Once you get to the website, you will find our address in Ghana, in the U.S., how to reach us, how to download our app. Everything is on that website. And you can also go on LinkedIn and search for Queza on LinkedIn, Queza at Queza on Facebook, and also on Instagram, and see what we're doing.
Great stuff. Great stuff. I really want to thank you for taking the time to share your journey, your insight, your thoughts, your personality with us. And I'm hoping that there is somebody somewhere who is listening to this in their car, on their way to work, on their way back from work, or somebody who is listening to this while they are, you know, doing some chores somewhere. But that person is nursing an idea. That person is passionate about a problem. That person is creative. They want to do something about a certain thing in the world. I'm hoping your story today, I'm hoping your experience will be an added push to that person, you know, to ask them, you know, yes, this might sound impossible, it might look difficult, but you can do it. And you've actually given us some very specific actionable points, especially about people, because I'm sure if I had to ask you, you are going to say that the foundation and pillar of what you have built so far is all around people. So thank you very, very much, Maxwell Adjo. I know you're a very busy person. I want to thank you for this appearance on the Small Starter Business Podcast. And I am promising the audience that I'll do what I can to bring you back as often as possible. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much, John Paul. I appreciate giving us the opportunity to share our story to inspire others. And thank you, all the listeners of Small Starter Podcast. Enjoy your day and have a wonderful weekend.
I hope you enjoyed this episode of the Small Starter Business Podcast. To take our free business courses or join one of our signature programs for special entrepreneurs like you, head over to smallstarter.com to join our private community. See you inside.